Chapter 36. Krishna has come. One day, while I was out on one of my subscription collecting expeditions, there occurred in my absence an incident which, while not unprecedented in my experience, was unusual enough to provide us with food for thought for some time afterwards. On returning to the ashram shortly before 1 o'clock, I found Satyapriya and Shankara Pillai waiting for me at the top of the steps leading up to the front veranda. Both were in a state of subdued, even suppressed excitement. Before I could open my mouth, Satyapriya exclaimed, "Shankara Pillai, tell Swamiji what I told you 30 minutes ago. Half amused, half embarrassed, Shankara Pillai related how, 30 minutes earlier, Satyapriya, who had been meditating, called out to him to serve lunch for 4 people instead of for 3 as usual, as he had heard me coming along the road beneath the compound wall, talking to one of the ashram members whose voice he had recognized. To their surprise, however, neither of us turned up, and when Shankara Pillai, anxious that the rice should not get cold, had gone to the gate to see what had become of us, there was nobody to be seen. Suspecting what might have happened, Satyapriya had then repeated, word for word, to Shankara Pillai the conversation that he had overheard between me and my companion, an unsuccessful Nair lawyer, whose invalid son I sometimes visited. To my astonishment and Satyapriya's jubilation, it transpired that the conversation was the very one I had had with the friend in question at his house on the outskirts of the Brahmin quarter exactly 30 minutes earlier. I had taken nearly 30 minutes to walk back to the ashram, and I had come alone without speaking to anybody on the way. Clearly it was a case of clear audience. Meditating, and probably with the thought of me somewhere at the back of his mind, Satyapriya had actually overheard me talking with my friend more than 30 miles away. Once our initial elation had subsided, we felt not a little awed and impressed, perhaps even slightly shaken. Strict silence about the matter having been enjoined on Shankara Pillai, Satyapriya and I returned to our meditations with renewed alacrity and vigour. While we were well aware that supernormal faculties, such as clairvoyance and clairaudience, were at best only by-products of the spiritual path, and that they were, in themselves, no indications of real spiritual progress, it was at least encouraging to know that such powers did actually exist, and that the accounts given of them in the Buddhist scriptures were not wholly mythical. Moreover, if the scriptural accounts of these supernormal faculties could be believed, as we now knew they could in part, it was all the more possible to accept their testimony as to the existence of even higher, purely transcendental states. This was not, of course, my first encounter with the supernormal, nor was it the first time that I had experienced it in connection with Satyapriya. Had I not seen him in Raipur when he was hundreds of miles away in New Delhi? It was not even the first time that something out of the ordinary had occurred at the ashram. The ashram was indeed a strange place with a strange atmosphere. Some months after our arrival, we had got into the habit of sleeping in the hall. Summer had begun, and our own small room was hot and stuffy. On our second or third night in the hall, we were awoken at about 2 o'clock in the morning by the sound of footsteps on the side veranda, which ran the whole length of the building. The footsteps passed up and down, coming now from one end of the veranda, now from the other, rather as though someone was using the place as an ambulatory. What was stranger still, the sound was not that of bare feet, but as it were of large, heavy, hobnailed army boots, such as no one in Muvattaputsa ever wore, and so loud as to be absolutely unmistakable. As soon as we opened the door and looked out onto the veranda, however, all was silent. There was nobody to be seen. Thereafter we heard the same footsteps every night, or whenever we happened to wake up at about 2 o'clock. They seemed to continue for about 30 minutes, and then ceased. Friends, to whom we discreetly mentioned the matter, told us that the ashram was popularly believed to be haunted, and that local people would not pass near it at night. In ancient times, it was said, a temple of the dark powers had stood on the spot, and sacrifice, even human sacrifice, had been offered there. Later on, something even stranger happened, this time only once, and to me alone. At 10 o'clock one evening, having finished my meditation, I opened my eyes to find myself surrounded by 7 or 8 tall black figures. I was sitting cross-legged at the back of the hall, in the left-hand corner, and the figures stood round me as though in a semicircle of light. They were 6 or 7 feet tall, naked, and as it were tubular in shape, being uniformly not more than 10 or 12 inches wide. What was more remarkable still, each of the figures possessed a pair of enormous white saucer eyes, and with these eyes they were all looking down at me. Their whole attitude and appearance, but particularly their eyes, were expressive of an indescribable mournfulness, of an infinite hopelessness and sadness, such as I had never seen, and which I had never imagined could exist. How long we remained looking at each other, I do not know. Perhaps it was 5 minutes, perhaps it was half an hour. Eventually, as the effect of the meditation started wearing off, I began feeling slightly uneasy. Rising to my feet, I walked straight through the figures and out onto the little veranda in between our own room and the storeroom on the courtyard side of the ashram. It was absolutely dark. Satchapriya was still meditating in the shrine, behind the grilled doors. Shankara Pillai, I knew, was doing something in the kitchen. After remaining on the veranda for a couple of minutes, I returned to the hall, sat down in my corner and looked. There was nothing there. Later I concluded that the figures I had seen must have been those of pretas, or hungry ghosts, a class of beings who, according to traditional Buddhist cosmology, inhabit one out of the 5 or 6 spheres of conditioned existence, the others being occupied respectively by gods, titans, animals, tormented beings, and men. Though I did not know it at the time, I ought to have spoken to the pretas and asked them what the matter was and whether I could do anything for them. In retrospect, it seems strange that I had not felt afraid of my ghostly visitants. No less strange was the fact that, on another occasion, when confronted by something of a more definitely spiritual nature, I did feel afraid. Perhaps the psychic is nothing to be afraid of, whereas the spiritual is. The incident in question took place in the shrine. As was my custom, having swept the place clean, I was decking the altar with fresh flowers in readiness for the morning puja. Along the edge of each of its 3 cement steps, I placed great scarlet hibiscuses, using 40 or 50 of the trumpet-shaped blossoms. On the treads of the steps, as well as on the floor around the base of the altar, I scattered the small, dark, brittle leaf of the sacred bell tree, mixed with white jasmine. Hibiscuses were also placed on top of the framed photographs of Sri Ramakrishna, the Holy Mother, and Swami Vivekananda. On special occasions they were garlanded, and their foreheads marked with fresh white sandalwood paste, as though they were living persons. There were no vases, as fresh offerings had to be made each morning, nothing being kept from the previous day. Suddenly, while I was thus engaged, the figure of Sri Ramakrishna appeared in mid-air above the altar, 4 or 5 feet from the ground. Though considerably larger than life, he appeared sitting in the usual cross-legged posture, looking exactly as he did in his photograph. He remained there for some time, certainly for at least several minutes, looking straight ahead as though unaware of my existence. Besides seeing the figure of Sri Ramakrishna, I also had an indescribably intense feeling of his actual presence, as though Thakur, as his disciples called him, was there in the room, and as though I was in close proximity to an incalculable spiritual force. It was this sense of presence and proximity that made me feel afraid. Indeed, I felt my hair stiffen at the roots, while shivers passed up and down my spine. It was an unnerving experience, and I was at a loss to account for it. The devotion which I had felt towards Sri Ramakrishna in Colombo had long since evaporated, and I certainly never meditated upon him or invoked his name. Could the apparition have been a kind of thought form created by the power of the regular ritual worship performed by Satchapriya and his predecessors at the ashram? Or had the ritual only evoked a spiritual presence that was there all the time, only waiting for a favourable opportunity to manifest itself? Was it not possible that after the death of his physical body, Sri Ramakrishna had continued to exist in a glorified spiritual form that might, under certain circumstances, become visible to his devotees? Was something of this sort the explanation of the resurrection of Christ? Questions of much the same sort were raised by yet another incident, which, like the incident of the clairaudience, involved Satchapriya, Shankara Pillai, and myself. It also involved a fourth resident at the ashram, a new arrival. Satchapriya and I being fully occupied with study and meditation, the care of the ashram, including the ashram land, had been left to Shankara Pillai. He was a willing enough worker, but what with planting tapioca in the lower half of the compound and supervising the picking and skinning of cashew nuts in the upper half, it was only natural that he should feel the need of an assistant. It was also only natural that he should eventually select for the post a poor orphan boy whose father had recently died and whose mother was unable to support him. Indeed, Shankara Pillai related, the poor little fellow was in danger of actual starvation, and even if he had not needed an assistant, it would have been our bounden duty to take him in. It was still more natural that the boy in question should be Shankara Pillai's own nephew, though this we did not know until later on. As soon as we saw our faithful manager leading him by the hand up the path, Satchapriya and I took a liking to the boy. His expression was one of unusual friendliness and intelligence, and when we questioned him, he replied without hesitation, his face breaking into a charming smile. His name was Krishna, he said, and he was 8 years old. With his large dark eyes and dusky complexion, and with a strip of scarlet cloth for his only clothing, he indeed looked like a little Krishna. All that was needed to complete the effect was a peacock feather in his hair. Before long he was making himself useful, and Satchapriya and I could not help smiling whenever we saw the little dark figure in the scarlet jockstrap trotting round the ashram at the heels of Shankara Pillai. One evening, before meditation, Satchapriya abruptly announced that Krishna was too good a boy to be allowed to lead a worldly life, and that he was going to make him his disciple. He would initiate him that very instant, and in future he would sit with us when we meditated. Calling the boy, he told him his plans, and said he was going to give him a mantra. Krishna's eyes sparkled with pleasure. Taking him into the hall, Satchapriya then told him to recite the well-known Hari mantra, in which now the name of Rama, now the name of Krishna, is interwoven with that of Hari or Vishnu, the second member of the Hindu Trinity, whose earthly incarnations, Rama and Krishna, are traditionally believed to be. Satchapriya had learnt this mantra as a boy, and we had often heard it sung at Ananda Mai's ashram in Kishanganj in the course of the evening bhajan sessions. Having initiated him, Satchapriya told Krishna to sit in the hall and repeat his mantra to himself while we meditated. If he did this properly, he declared, Krishna would appear to him. By the time we got started that evening, it was 7 o'clock, At about 10, having finished our meditation, Satyapriya and I rose to our feet. To our astonishment, Krishna was still sitting in the upper end of the hall, in the right-hand corner, exactly where we had left him. He was sitting cross-legged on the bare floor, with his hands folded in his lap, and was gazing fixedly ahead. Satyapriya called him, but he did not stir, and we went down to the kitchen without him. At 11 o'clock he was still sitting there. By this time Satyapriya was beginning to feel worried. The mantra was supposed to be a very powerful one. Suppose it had been too much for the boy. Suppose he had gone into some kind of trance. Suppose he should be unable to regain normal consciousness and should go on sitting there indefinitely. By this time Shankara Pillai, whom we had told about the matter over dinner, had come and joined us, bringing with him a coconut oil lamp. Drawing up mats, the three of us sat down near Krishna and awaited developments. He was smiling gently, and his breathing was deep and regular. Satyapriya called him again, more loudly than before, but he continued gazing ahead with wide-open eyes and gave no sign of having heard. At 12 o'clock, Satyapriya decided that something would have to be done. He had heard that a person who had gone into trance could be brought back to ordinary consciousness by repeating in his ear the same mantra that he had been repeating prior to his going into trance, if, of course, this was known. Satyapriya, Shankara Pillai, and I accordingly started reciting the Hari mantra. At first we recited it softly, but as this had no effect, we started repeating it more and more loudly, until in the end we were shouting it into Krishna's ear, with all the force of our lungs. It was a bizarre scene. Round the ashram, darkness and silence. Inside, the sound of the Hari mantra, the glow of the coconut oil lamp on the bare walls, the unconscious figure of the small boy, the anxious faces of the three adults. At 1 o'clock we were still shouting. The raucous sound could hardly be called chanting. From time to time, in desperation, Satyapriya slapped Krishna or shook him bodily. But none of these drastic measures produced the slightest effect. Krishna had gone limp, however, and Satyapriya, who was sitting cross-legged on the floor, was cradling him in his lap, with the boy's head resting in the crook of his arm. Suddenly there flashed on me a picture of something I had seen many years before on the Monkey Hill at London Zoo. It was a picture of a female baboon sitting clasping her dead infant to her breast, refusing to give it up, though it had been dead many days, and refusing to allow anyone near. But Krishna was not dead yet, and the hoarse, desperate sound of our shouting continued to be heard. Anyone passing by the ashram that night would have thought it was haunted indeed, and that tormented spirits were wailing their agonies to the four winds of heaven. Satyapriya shouted loudest of all. By this time he was almost frantic with anxiety, and bawled out the mantra as though Krishna's very life, and his own too, depended on his exertions. At 2 o'clock the boy suddenly drew a very deep breath and sighed. We redoubled our efforts. Before long Krishna drew another deep breath, then another. The trance was coming to an end. He was returning to normal consciousness. Shankara Pillai, who had been much less worried than Satyapriya and myself, spoke to him in a cheerful, encouraging tone. Eventually the boy blinked his eyes and looked up at us with an expression of happy recognition. It was as though he had just awoken from a deep, refreshing sleep and was pleased to see familiar faces round his bed. Shankara Pillai spoke to him again. This time he responded instantly in his usual clear, distinct tones. Seeing that the boy was apparently none the worse for his experience, Satyapriya at once started questioning him. What had happened? Had he seen anything? Rather shyly, Krishna confessed that he had seen his divine namesake, and that they had played together. Had he enjoyed playing with him? Oh, yes, very much indeed. The smile that accompanied this statement was more expressive than any words. And in what form did Sri Krishna appear to you? Satyapriya finally demanded. He was a little boy, came the reply, just like me. This was too much for the overwrought nerves of my friend. Already half crazed with relief after the tensions of the night, Satyapriya now suddenly leapt to his feet and started gyrating wildly round the hall, hopping now on this foot and now on that, and shouting, "Krishna has come! Krishna has come!" in a loud voice, hoarse with hysteria. He seemed to think that, since the boy had seen Sri Krishna, the latter had quite literally visited the ashram. Shankara Pillai and I looked on in amazement. Satyapriya seemed to have gone quite mad. Round and round the hall he went, leaping and dancing, shouting and sobbing, a grotesque and slightly alarming sight. I was irresistibly reminded of the scene I had once witnessed at Anandamayi's ashram, when devotees collapsed on the floor shrieking and foaming at the mouth. Such was the violence of Satyapriya's movements that after a few minutes his sarong fell off, but he took no notice and continued dancing naked round the room, his arms raised above his head and his black hair streaming behind him. The yellow lamplight shone on his stalwart bronze body, by this time gleaming with sweat, and threw onto the walls and up among the rafters an enormous black shape whose movements were even more fantastic than his own. Within half an hour his emotion had exhausted itself. Sobbing for breath, he dropped to the ground, and as soon as he had recovered himself, we went to bed. During the next few days, the dramatic consequences of Krishna's initiation were the main topic of conversation at the ashram. Shankara Pillai was inclined to treat the whole matter lightly, saying that such experiences were common enough and of no more significance than a vivid dream. Satyapriya and I were not so sure. According to the books on Bengal Vaishnavism I had read during my first visit to Calcutta when still in the army, the subtle forms of Sri Krishna and his consort Radha eternally sported in the celestial Brindaban, while, according to Mahayana tradition, the Buddha eternally proclaimed the Dharma in his body of glory on the spiritual vulture's peak. Was there, then, a world of divine archetypes underlying or overlaying or interpenetrating the realm of material existence? And did Krishna's experience represent a glimpse of this world through the tinted lenses of a Hindu upbringing? Again, had his experience been simply the result of his childish belief in Satyapriya's words, or was it the more or less spontaneous manifestation of a disposition innately spiritual? Would it be wise to allow him to go on repeating the Hari Mantra? The last question, at least, was answered for us. Before we could make up our minds what to do, Krishna's mother, whom we had not seen before, appeared one morning on the ashram steps and declared that she was taking him home with her. What Shankara Pillai had told her we never knew, but it was plain she did not want her son to be Satyapriya's disciple or to become a monk. Having touched our feet in farewell, Krishna left the ashram as cheerfully as he had come. The last we saw of him was a smile and a flash of red jockstrap, as, ducking between the bamboos, he disappeared through the gate. With Satyapriya, Shankara Pillai and I on our own again, and with life once more flowing in its old channels, many of the questions raised by the latest incident at the ashram soon lost much of their significance. For me, at least, however, one question remained as urgent as ever. If anything, indeed, it gained rather than lost in urgency as the days went by. This question concerned Satyapriya. Ever since the night of Krishna's vision, or whatever the experience might have been that the boy had had, I could not get out of my mind the picture of my friend gyrating wildly round the hall, completely overcome by hysteria. Nor could I help wondering whether his mental balance, precarious at the best of times, had not been seriously affected by the prolonged strain of our ascetic way of life, as well as by the still more rigorous discipline to which he had recently subjected himself. Indeed, there were moments when I doubted his sanity altogether. Despite undoubted achievements in meditation, ever since he had given up the industrial school project, his constitutional unreasonableness and irritability had grown steadily worse, and his liability to periodic outbursts of insane fury more and more pronounced. Once or twice, indeed, his lack of self-control had culminated in actual violence. Talking in the semi-darkness of the veranda one night after dinner, we happened to find ourselves disagreeing over something. Knowing how sensitive Satchaprio was, and how impatient of contradiction, I at once saw the danger and stopped pressing my point. But it was too late. Despite all my efforts to pacify him, my friend insisted on enlarging the difference as much as possible, and working himself up into one of his usual terrible rages. It was as though he wanted to be angry. This time, however, pausing in his tirade, he suddenly struck me a tremendous blow in the face with his fist. No sooner was the blow struck than his anger left him. By the time Shankara Pillai, hearing me cry out, had come running up onto the veranda, Satchaprio was dabbing my bleeding cheek with his shoulder towel and rocking me in his arms in an agony of remorse. Though he told Shankara Pillai that I had accidentally banged my head against a pillar in the dark, and though I confirmed this story as best I could, our manager was not to be deceived. Not only was he well acquainted with Satchaprio's irascibility, but he had heard his voice raise in anger for some minutes before the supposed accident occurred. As a result of the blow, I had a black eye for a week, while the left side of my head remained practically devoid of sensation for years. On another occasion, it was Shankara Pillai who was the victim, or very nearly the victim, of Satchaprio's lack of self-control. Unexpectedly going through the household accounts one night, and meticulously checking the cost of each bunch of bananas and every ounce of cooking oil, my friend discovered that the cash was short by the equivalent of nearly a shilling. After prolonged inquisition, Shankara Pillai tremblingly confessed that over the last 2 months he had, by instalments, misappropriated the amount from the money that he had been given for the purchase of provisions from the bazaar. Further inquiry revealed that the reason for the theft was his secret addiction to bidis, or country cigarettes. Shocked and indignant, Satchaprio took the culprit severely to task, and despite his tears and entreaties, gradually became more and more incensed. Eventually, seizing a heavy stick, he made to grab him by the scruff of his neck and administer a good thrashing. But Shankara Pillai was too quick for him. With a shriek of terror, he darted through the kitchen door and out into the darkness. Now, thoroughly roused, Satchaprio dashed after him. Over the compound wall went Shankara Pillai. Over the compound wall went Satchaprio. As it was a dark night with no moon, it was some minutes before either of them was able to get his bearings, and I could hear the sound of bodies crashing about among the lantana bushes. At last, Shankara Pillai found the path. Guided by the sound of his footsteps, Satchaprio found it too, and soon the sound of two pairs of running feet, as well as the imprecations of the pursuer and the supplications of the pursued, died away into the distance. Half an hour later, his intended victim having given him the slip, Satchaprio reappeared. For 2 days we had to do without a manager. Then, through the intercession of one of the ashram members with whom he had taken refuge, Shankara Pillai returned, humbled himself at Satchaprio's feet, apologised, professed repentance and reformation, and was at length magnanimously forgiven, though not without stern warnings of what would happen if the offence was ever repeated. Such a priest's lack of mental balance, as well as his increasing inability to control his temper, was in my mind not unconnected with a set of exercises he had learned from his books on Hatha Yoga. These were not ordinary physical exercises, but a form of pranayama, or breath control. As I knew very well from my own experience, and all the books on the subject I had read repeatedly emphasised, exercises that involved the control of the breath, as distinct from simply watching it, had an extremely powerful effect on the nervous system, and could therefore be highly dangerous. They should be practised only under the personal guidance of a fully qualified teacher. According to popular belief, unsupervised practice of pranayama heated the brain. All this I pointed out to Satchapriya as soon as I discovered what he was doing, but with his usual self-confidence, he brushed aside my pleas for caution and carried on as before. Indeed, so ardent was his desire for spiritual progress that he went so far as to practice the breath control exercises in a particularly extreme form. He also lengthened his periods of silence and started fasting for weeks on end. But apart from reducing him to a state of extreme physical weakness and emaciation, these drastic measures produced not the slightest effect. The periodic insane outbursts of rage continued, and to our mutual distress, the personal differences between us became more and more acute. By this time, we had been at the ashram for more than a year. Already, for the second time since our arrival, the air was filled with the sound of Ayyappan Saranang, as bands of devotees who had started the long and arduous pilgrimage to Sabarimalai made their way through the town. Krishna Pillai, the Yankal master, and other friends who were devotees of the god, strongly urged us to accompany them this time and see for ourselves the wonders of the timber-built mountain shrine that was the holy of holies of the cult, promising to look after us on the way and render us every possible assistance. With friendly importunity, they hung round our necks the basil-wood rosaries that were the traditional insignia of those who had vowed to undertake the pilgrimage. But though we wore the rosaries and often talked of going, and though in a sense we wanted to go, the situation at the ashram was such that, not knowing what to do, we allowed the weeks to go by without coming to a decision. In the end, unable to wait any longer, our friends had to leave without us. By the time they returned, the situation had changed, and Satchapriya and I had begun to see a way out of our difficulties. Developments had taken place that not only carried us a stage further along the path within, but resulted in our making a journey that took us even further afield than Sabarimalai. Indeed, they resulted in our leaving Travancore altogether.